Hey listeners, welcome back to the show. My guests for this conversation tonight are Tim and Lance from Crawlspace Media. Tim and Lance are documentarians and podcast hosts. They're co-hosts for the very popular shows Missing and Empty Frames. I hope you enjoyed tonight's conversation. Tim and Lance, Crawlspace Media, the podcast is missing, and we'll also get into some empty frames tonight. Gentlemen, welcome. This is an honor, really. Thank you.
Thank you.
The honor is all on this side of the Zoom screen.
Well, you're too kind. You know, we have lots to unpack tonight, but as always, let's start by asking you both to give me a little background on your education, your careers up to this point. Tim, we'll start with you tonight.
Oh boy, education. Jeez.
Yeah, sure. Let's find out how smart you are.
Well, I did graduate high school. No, I did go to the fine establishment, Medford High School. I do have an associate's degree for performing arts from Middlesex Community College.
Interesting.
And yeah. And I did a bunch of acting back in the day. And I actually moved to LA in 2004 to pursue acting as a profession. I came back towards Boston, Massachusetts, 2014-2015 time frame, and to raise a family. Yeah. And had worked some as an actor. I'd worked a lot behind the scenes, had started doing some podcast stuff, some comedy stuff, some sports stuff, but nothing that really stuck. Came back and launched the podcast and got crazy with old pal Lance.
Well, that brings us to Lance. What about you, sir?
Well, you know, I did graduate high school as well, and I did move on to a fine college in Keene, New Hampshire, where I studied, of all things, theater design.
Wow.
That was my primary. Don't really talk about it that much because it was so long ago, and I really did not put the effort into it as I probably should have during that time period of my life, but yeah, it did come in handy. I worked in the events industry for a long time. That was my primary, I don't know, vocation, I guess you'd say, setting up events, helping to design events, and just like working the logistics around planning events. So yeah, I guess it did incorporate itself nicely into my professional life, but also on the side, always was a bartender, you know, at some point in my life. Those are these periods where I would have like very consistent work, and then it was like, you know what, I'm gonna bartend again. And some of those moments were necessity.
Yeah.
And some of them were just choice, like I want to get back out to like the service industry. Yeah. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, Tim and I met doing murder mystery, comedy murder mystery dinner theater, where we would write and produce and direct and book, you know, just do the like run the whole thing. It was our own company.
Nice.
And we incorporated a lot of the people that we worked with in the restaurant industry. They would be part of the shows. And it was so fun. It was a real, like, you know, rock star lifestyle.
Nice.
If you're talking about the murder mystery dinner theater circuit, we were like the motley crew of that dinner theater circuit. And it was so fun. But you know, it led to other things like short films, just like piecing things together. Back in the day, like, you couldn't shoot things on your phone because your phone was attached to the wall by a spiral cord.
Right.
So you had to actually find a good camera, find, you know, a good way to edit, and all of that was just so clunky back then. So to shoot and actually release something that was like more than, I don't know, 7 minutes was like, I mean, it was more money than we'd seen in our lives, right? It was more money in our bank accounts combined. So we did our best. We had some shorts and a feature, and, you know, made some good friends along the way. And then when Tim moved away, I went back into the events world, the bartending world. And then, when he came back, we started getting into, true crime.
Yeah.
And it was just an accident.
Yeah.
We were doing some video work for the events industry, like shooting weddings and, you know, some fundraising events and just like private parties. And during that course of the time, we discovered the Maura Murray disappearance. And that led to, wow, this is fascinating. What a fascinating community this is, having that desire to make some sort of like medium or make some sort of product for the documentary medium. We wanted to look into the community that was so fascinated by Maura's disappearance. And that's what led to the podcast. And that's what led to all of the millions of dollars and accolades that we have today.
All right, let's get right into it tonight. You mentioned already Maura Murray. You talked a little bit about how sort of that case came to you. Let's expand on that. Do you guys remember sort of when you first initially heard about Moore's disappearance and what prompted you to get involved in this case in particular?
Yeah, this is Lance's part of the story because because he's the one who first heard of the case.
Yeah, so like I said before, we were doing some videos for the events world, wedding videos. And back then when you were editing a wedding video or when you were editing anything digitally, there was some time that went by where you needed to let your sequence on Final Cut or whatever you're using render. So if you put some crossfades in or some effects in, you couldn't really get a good playback until you rendered it and you could see it in real time. So the rendering process took anywhere from like 30 seconds to, you know, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, depending on how long you had to render. So I would always like have my laptop there. And when I would render, I would just like kind of go online and look up something that wasn't the wedding or the event that I was looking at just to, you know, mix it up in my brain. I was always interested in this murder that took place in Peterborough, New Hampshire in 1987, January of 1987, the murder of Craig Lane. He was a 17-year-old young man who was working at a gas station, like one of those little island gas stations that only had like, I think that one had four gas pumps. He was murdered. And I remember that when I was super young, I was probably like 10 or 11 at the time, but my sisters were older and they remember it really well because they went to school with his friends. It was a neighboring town. Yeah. And he was just brutally stabbed like 20 something times. I can't remember, but he died. And the composite sketch was something that my friends and I had always looked at when we were walking to school or just, you know, walking around town. The composite sketch of the perpetrator was like so like emotionless and blank and expressionless, but so terrifying to look at as like a 11 or 12 year old kid. Yeah. It was right after one of the anniversaries of his murder, which almost coincides with Maura Murray's disappearance. Hers being at the beginning of February, Craig's was at the end of January.
Yeah.
So I think there was like an anniversary thing in the newspaper that jogged my memory. I saw the composite sketch. So I go online and I Google unsolved murders, New Hampshire. So his doesn't come up, but even though Maura isn't an unsolved murder, the algorithms pick up on that and it's unsolved. So Maura Murray comes up. And that's how I first discovered Maura Murray, was looking up the murder of Craig Lane.
Wow.
Maura Murray leads me to James Renner's blog, and then I'm down the rabbit hole.
Yeah.
And then I'm just like, look at this. What is this? Yeah. Like, single car accident, kind of sketchy reporting on it at the time, or not reporting, sketchy witness reporting. Like, was she drunk? Was she standing here? Was she out of the car? Was she in the car? Was there somebody smoking? And into the more you read into this and the more people commented on James's blog, the more I'm looking at it and then realizing, okay, the video that I was editing had been done rendering for like a half hour and I needed to get back to work. So that's where I discovered Maura Murray.
Yeah.
I think when Tim came into where we were working, it was like a little warehouse. God, to describe this place. So in the events industry, we had this warehouse where it was being renovated, but we rented out like a 3,300 square foot section of warehouse on the first floor that housed all of the inventory. And the rest of the building was probably like 80% empty.
Yeah.
There was all these offices, maybe 10 by 10, 20 by 20 offices. And I don't know, I think I was paying like $50 a month just to put like a couple of computers in one to do some side hustle editing for video projects. I think Tim popped his head in. We were both working on a wedding video, or we were working on separate videos. And I was just like, dude, have you heard of this?
Yeah.
And that's where she came into our world.
Tim, for those listeners that maybe aren't so familiar with the case, I mean, it's a very well-known case, but you know, there might be some people that aren't really familiar with it. Can you give me an overview of what happened on the evening of, I think it's February 9th, right, of 2004 now? It's been a while.
Yeah.
Can you give everybody an overview of what happened that night or what we know so far?
Yeah, some of the exact details may still be debated, but I'll give you the best rundown that I have. So she was a student at UMass Amherst, which is in Western Massachusetts, and for nursing school.
Yeah.
And she left that university around 3:30 p.m. is I think what we believe, and headed north up Route 91, went into New Hampshire, actually crossed into Vermont, and it goes back into New Hampshire. That's that highway. And she ended up about 3 hours away from UMass and in the White Mountains of New Hampshire, you know, not like on a mountainside or anything, but kind of on like a mountain pass road that there is no service, no cell service at that spot. And there is still none today, 18 years later.
Wow.
It is pretty like rural in that sense, but like there are houses around, you know, there were calls to the police after she reportedly spun her car out and kind of like around. And so there were two calls to the police, or actually I should say one of them, and then a bus came by and the bus driver spoke with Maura, asked her if she needed any assistance. She said, no, thank you. She apparently asked him not to call police. She had told him that she had called AAA, I think, in the hopes that he would not call police. But he being a resident and actually lived like right almost across the street, he knew that there was no cell service, so she couldn't have called AAA.
Yeah.
So he dialed 911, and about 10 minutes later, the police arrived and Maura's car was locked and she was gone and has not been seen since.
About a month ago, and correct me if I'm wrong, there were some developments in the case. Lance, can you talk about what those developments were?
Yeah. So there were, so there's always been these breaks, quote unquote, in Maura's disappearance, because there's so many people that are looking into it. And there's a lot of red flags. A lot of antennas go up when a bone is found up there, or some like article of clothing in the general area. Tim did mention that she wasn't in the White Mountains. I think that's a little to say, when you hear about her mystery, you hear like she was lost in the White Mountains. And Tim tried to clarify that it wasn't like a mountainside.
Yeah.
Her car was on one of the main crossroads that went, you know, kind of through the mountains. So anytime you get something in that area, again, like we're talking about a place where people go up there all the time to hike and to camp and everything, it always comes up.
Yeah.
You know, an article of clothing, a bone fragment always comes up. A couple of years ago, there was something where some bones were discovered around, was it Lincoln or was it Franconia, where it turned out to be sort of like when an old graveyard, an old cemetery washes out. So you have like bones that are like a couple of generations old that have gone like in the undercurrent underground.
Yeah.
So they kind of turn up in a construction site. But anyway, so that was kind of a red flag that turned out to be nothing. And then there's been many digs and GPR investigations at certain areas around there. But the one that you're speaking about is the Loon Mountain one.
Yeah.
And Loon Mountain has always been this lightning rod in the case, because there's this elusive Loon Mountain 3, that these three men that have come up in the folklore of Maura Murray's disappearance, the Loon Mountain 3, were they working that night? Was there, you know, who was it? What did they do? They made snow on Loon Mountain. So, and it sounds creepy, right? Loon Mountain, the Loon Mountain 3. So what you're talking about is these, there was a construction, renovation, installation of a new, chairlift at Loon Mountain Ski Resort. It's a very popular ski resort up there. So they're constructing a new chairlift, which is like eight chairs on, you know, on the ski lift, whatever they call it, the oct something.
Yeah.
So there was like eight chairs, and it was being installed at a location where the old one was being removed or being renovated. So they were working on the old iteration of this, and that's where they found the bones. Now, when you start looking into the rumors of who worked at Loon Mountain, there are rumors of certain people that might be connected to Maura's disappearance based on what others have said about what these people have said.
Yeah.
Hopefully that makes sense.
Yeah.
So,
right.
Yeah. It's pretty much local rumor.
Yeah.
Then it's like, okay, well, this person here has been spoken about in Maura's disappearance. This person here had a connection to a construction company who would be probably contracted to do a job like renovate a ski lift at Loon Mountain. And the first one that they were doing happened in the same bracket of time that not when Maura would had disappeared, but when Maura would disappear and then the following summer, because she disappeared in February. No one's burying a body in the frozen earth in February. So that first round of construction at Loon Mountain would have taken place in a time where somebody would have taken the opportunity, had they known, to just dump a body in an area where they knew construction was going to happen.
Yeah.
Things were going to get filled in and this ski lift was going to be installed. What a great way to dispose of a body that would probably never be found. Not not knowing that maybe that would be pulled back up for a better ski lift. So that's what we were thinking.
Yeah.
And that's where the bones are found. And the more he tried to discount it, the harder it was, because it was like, yeah, who else would it be?
Mm-hmm.
And it just made sense. So the first ski lift was going up back then. Okay, this person with access can go up there, simply dump it in, simply fill it in. Even if they filled it in with a thin layer of dirt, who's mm-hmm. going to look at that? Cement yeah. goes right on top of that. So that's what it felt like. And they pulled up these bones, and we were hearing a lot of rumblings, We were even hearing that the family's thinking like, this feels different. Law enforcement saying mm-hmm. this, not saying, but, you know, hearing the rumblings, this feels different. And then the results came back that the bones were from an individual between like 1778 and 1940.
Wow.
So yeah, the bones are old, but you know,
too old,
like way too old. And I have yeah. no idea. I could see if they said like between like 1840 and 1940.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get like 1778? And did they have a coin on them?
For real. That's
it was super frustrating, because we've had moments like that where we're like, is this it? Law enforcement's calling a press conference to say mm-hmm. we didn't find anything. Mm-hmm. You know, we've had moments like that. Like, well, mm-hmm. why are you even calling a press conference yeah. to say yeah. you didn't find anything? And then this, where everyone was shut up about it, everyone had their mouth shut and it just felt different. And then yeah. it just didn't, there was an individual who was there, and hopefully that identity is hopefully they know that identity, or they're on their way to discovering who it was. And again, it really probably is just like from some unmarked graveyard or cemetery that was just, you know, washed yeah. out or built up around, you know, over the course of a couple hundred years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Super deflating. This case has so many of those super deflating moments.
A lot of twists and turns,
I would imagine. And it's the stakes are really high. I mean, like, look at something like the Earhart case, which is, it's going to be 85 years old this July. You know, that's been moved into sort of the historical mystery category because of its age and because of who was involved in that disappearance. But this is a whole other thing. I mean, that must be, you just mentioned it, deflating. That's a really great term. What's the reaction like for you guys every time something comes up, you know, in this case, no matter how big or how small? I mean, is there excitement there? Is there like this like looming thought of like, oh man, like they found her, and this is not the outcome we hoped. Obviously we all didn't want this outcome. I mean, what does that feel like for you guys covering this case as in depth and as long as you have?
Well, I would say, we've never tried to like be the first story out there, because, you know, we don't have journalism backgrounds. We're not, you know, we're not like trying to scoop anybody. So a lot of times we like to let the dust settle, even if like, even if a major news outlet were to cover something that we wanted to cover, you know, it would be fine because we could just rely on that reporting as well. And you know, use that too.
Yeah.
So it is a little topsy turvy. I mean, there's so many twists, like several per year, that I would say we like to give it some time. That's another reason why we don't like try to rush to a podcast or something like that. You know,
yeah.
if there is a twist, like, because things come and go very quickly in this case, sometimes every day, that we like to make sure this one is hanging around for a while, if that makes sense.
When we hear about something, you have to imagine that the family has heard about it before we've heard about it, unless the family hasn't been contacted about this. So in that case, we're hearing about it pretty much at the same time as the family.
Yeah.
And to come out and try to, you know, show what we're feeling is so like awkward and odd and kind of gross to us to come out and be like, you know, another gut punch for us. We're just two dudes who are doing a podcast about it. We tend to let the dust settle on these things, because no matter how tempting it is to come out and say something, 99.9% of the time you'll be wrong and you'll look like an asshole. You'll lose all credibility.
That's a great way to say it. And I think that the empathy obviously shows, you know, in the way you guys cover this case. We'll talk about the transition in just a moment, but you guys have dedicated a lot of time obviously to working on this case. Lance, I'll ask you this. Unfortunately, there are so many disappearance cases in this country. Why is this one getting as much attention as it's gotten? I mean, there's so many that for every one case that gets, you know, a flood of attention, there's probably 100 that just are, you know, fall by the wayside. I don't have to tell you guys that. Why do you think this case in particular seems to resonate so much with just even a general audience?
Yeah, I think the unfortunate truth of it is that she is very familiar looking to people. When people look at that face, and they see, you know, I don't want to go down that road of like missing white girl syndrome.
Yeah, yeah,
because
sure.
Even if you are a white girl and you've gone missing, you have not done anything to deserve that. And yeah. You should get coverage as well. But it is something that media will grip and show you until you have no choice but to say, I guess this means something.
Yeah.
And I think that's why Maura's case hasn't left the public eye. And when we started doing this, it was because of that passion in the community saying we need to find answers for the family and we need to find answers for just Maura's memory. You look at the face, the dimples, the smile. Mm-hmm. She's presented as the all-American girl who was going hiking. And then you have that dark undercurrent, which is... But was she that American girl?
Yeah.
What did she have dark secrets? And then people will start taking, and you know, James Renner has done it and mm-hmm. we've said it to his face that you take those moments of like, well, anyone of that age gets in trouble. Mm-hmm. Tell me somebody who was at UMass Amherst at her age that wasn't having going to parties on the weekend, you know, so to say she's a party girl, she mm-hmm. was doing this, she yeah. was doing that, like all of these things. So then you have that, I don't even know what it is. It's like the train wreck mentality or the wound culture that yeah. we learned about. Like you want, you see that perfect image, but then kind of subconsciously want that perfect image to be more flawed than you. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's how her persona was delivered to the public. And it is unfortunate, but I think that's why she gets that much attention. And then it just snowballs. Mm-hmm. It just snowballs. Like, you can't make a comment online about it without having 30 comments come back at you that you're wrong. And you're so wrong.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of like in a weird, weird, weird way, kind of fueled us a little bit where it's like, God, now we have to go back. Now we have to keep charging forward with this.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I think 100% that helped to fuel us. And I think that's a very valid answer to that question.
Yeah.
You know, I think missing white women syndrome has kind of evolved over the years where we're so like, that's such a common phrase now. Mm-hmm. And everyone saw what happened with Gabby Petito and everyone saw it a mile away and yep. called it out.
Yep.
While yes, that is really one of the answers to your question about why Maura's case is so popular. Another answer is there's two mysteries. Why was she up there anyway? That's never really been solved.
Yeah.
And where is she now? But also it's the community. And that is what I think keeps people around now.
Yeah.
Is the mystery. And really there's a lot of intrigue online in this case. You know, if you get involved in it, you can go really deep down that rabbit hole yourself and come out a different person, quite literally.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen that.
Yeah.
Or even just get into battles or get creeped out, get threatened even online. I mean, these are things that have happened recently and will happen again, you know, because that's the cycle here.
Yeah.
People want to solve it. And I'm not trying to be crass, but it is the perfect missing person amateur sleuth case.
Yeah, I totally get it.
Tim said there's two mysteries. Why was she there? Why was she there alone? Why was she driving her car, which was not running well, so many miles away in a different state? Where was she going? Why was she going there? What happened in the days before? That's an insane mystery. So complicated, so tied up in knots that has possibly absolutely nothing to do with, other than the geographical location, as to why she went missing, who took her, where'd she go. It could have absolutely nothing to do. Two mutually exclusive moments in this person's life coming together for this car, empty car in the middle of the White Mountains.
It boggles your mind. It is insane, you know. And I remember, like, last season I had Sarah Turney on the show. We spoke about, you know, this is before all the developments in that case broke. And of course we won't get into it because I know that's an ongoing thing, but Sarah talked about leveraging social media, TikTok in particular, to sort of break new ground in that case. And I was stunned, but I wasn't surprised because, you know, that by the impact really that movement had. And correct me if I'm wrong, Maura's sister, Julie, is sort of followed suit and taken the ball and ran with it with that and has had success there. I think a newfound success with just awareness. What is social media, and in particular, like TikTok, for whatever reason, why is that such a big deal? Why does it have so much power? We've had Twitter, we've had Facebook and all that stuff, and that's all well and good, of course, with awareness. But what does something like TikTok, the sort of the relatively new platform, do for cases like this? I mean, how does it reignite a case that may have gone cold or just may have been maybe dormant for whatever reason?
Well, I will tell you what has been told to us over the last few months, maybe a dozen times by various industry professionals. But no, TikTok is doing something different with their algorithm than the other social media platforms right now. Mm-hmm. They are focusing on, I guess you could say, more of the right details.
Yeah.
You can go viral easier on TikTok than any other social media platform right now. Mm-hmm. For example, if you are to post a YouTube video on Twitter, they will sort of deflate the potential for that to go viral.
Yeah.
And TikTok is just a different animal. You know, if you haven't spent a lot of time there, there isn't as much sort of interaction. Mm-hmm. That's kind of one reason I think a viral sort of video happens in a different way, I think, via TikTok. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, that does. And I sadly will admit that I've spent far too much time on that app and got my my wife into it and my sister-in-law into it. It's pretty bad. But we, you know, we love it. And it's interesting to see, like, I read that article about you know, Sarah and TikTok and kind of how that transformed that case. And it's pretty remarkable, like, the, you know, gaining or leveraging that audience and what that can do for, you know, any kind of case, really. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. What's impressive to me about TikTok and what Sarah's done with it is that TikTok reaches a generation that, so you have Facebook and then Twitter is like the truncated version of Facebook. Yeah. And like Tim said, there's more interaction there because you can message, like, in, you know, mm-hmm. for the public to see. And that's, I think that's where sort of the, I don't know, the action is on Twitter, but the way Sarah and numerous other people have harnessed the power of TikTok, and maybe this was intentional on TikTok's part, but mm-hmm. everyone talks about how, like, a younger generation, you know, the attention span is so short. So mm-hmm. yeah, what are you doing? You're putting a moving image, a big moving image, like, that's most of the screen. It's not little text boxes. It's most of the screen where you see somebody's face.
Yeah.
And if you see somebody's face, like Sarah's face, very, very passionate, sometimes she has, like, tears in her eyes about something, you're going to stop.
Right.
And you're going to all of a sudden, like, yeah, all right, I'm going to give a little bit of my attention here.
Yeah.
And then you hear what her message is. And then it's like, oh, there's links. Okay, all right, I'm going to look at this.
Yeah.
So they figured out a way to capture that short attention span and expand it into something else. And then that person, super quick, check this out.
Yeah.
To the next person, check this out, check this out, check this out.
Yeah.
They figured that out. It's really brilliant.
Yeah.
It's really, it absolutely overwhelms and terrifies me, but it's yeah. really brilliant way yeah. to capture that short attention span. And it's not by yeah. their own fault. Like
right.
the younger generation did not ask for all this. Mm-hmm. Like, they were born into it. So, hey, however you can capture that short attention span and turn it into a longer attention span where they spread the word. Awesome.
Yeah.
I also think, you know, with those two examples, Sarah Turney and Julie Murray specifically, like, they've shared a lot of really personal things mm-hmm. about their missing sisters. And, you know, whether it's video footage or notes that were, you know, left. Like, so I think that really captures people's attention too, in addition to what Lance was saying about, like, the composition of how that app kind of works.
Yeah.
And I guess how personal it can be. Right. But I think that's really what it is. Yeah, that personal touch.
Yeah. Well, let's move forward a little bit. When was the decision made, really, and how was it made to sort of transition to other cases and sort of redirect the course of the show? I mean, I know it's, you guys are doing it obviously with the same professionalism, the same detail and everything, but when did you guys decide you wanted to sort of transition and cover other cases for missing?
Well, we were asked by Bruce Maitland, who is the father of Brianna Maitland, who is a missing young woman from Vermont, mm-hmm. Montgomery, Vermont, in March of 2004. Mm-hmm. And he asked us to be on the board of his nonprofit that he was starting, called Private Investigations for the Missing. And I think this was back in 2017, 2018. And so that nonprofit is really functioning now. And I would say that was really what led the charge to cover other cases because we saw how many families of missing people submitted. They wanted not even coverage necessarily. They do. And there are a lot that do, but they want a private investigator. Mm-hmm. you know, and assigned to their loved one's case. When PIs for the missing can do that with the resources we have, then we try to do that. If the case really fits that right criteria, then we do it. But if not, a lot of those cases will end up on the missing podcast, and we'll speak about them. A lot of times we'll interview a family member and you know, let them speak as well.
You know, speaking of, I know this has sort of been a heavy conversation tonight so far, but speaking of other cases and other things, let's transition a little bit and discuss empty frames, because that's something that you know, we've talked about offline between us three and Jen from Vanish as well. How do you go from a case as heavy as this one to a museum heist? I mean, it's a brilliant transition, by the way, but how did you guys do that? And I love the transition to the empty frames background, by the way. That's a brilliant transitioning as well. How does that happen for you guys? And why did you guys decide to transition to this particular case?
Can I say, like, what one thing, the very first like thought that we had, we're like, oh, stolen art? This is like a victimless crime. This is going to be like so much
fun,
easier and like lighter. This isn't a big deal.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, we've gotten literal death threats in covering the Gardner heist, where that really hasn't happened in Moore's case. Not that I'm asking for it, God knows.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was we actually got approached by a local fellow in Boston who had a great interest in this case since he saw the documentary Stolen, which is about the Gardner heist and sort of the various characters who have investigated that over the years, much like the Moore case, actually, now that I think about it, now that I say it out loud. So he's sort of, you know, lit this fire under us, and we ended up pairing with Audio Boom for the first season.
Yeah.
And we really looked into it. Unbeknownst to us, there was, or when we began this journey, there was a another Gardner heist project that was underway, which actually limited some of the involvement some of the access, I should say, that we were able to get.
Yeah.
But what that allowed us to do is sort of get into the nitty gritty a little bit more, sort of into those cracks that that the glossier projects won't find.
Yeah.
And I think the community who follows everything on the Gardner heist will tell you that some of those interviews are, you know, very valuable to that community because they have never heard that stuff. Mm. And the kind of thing I'm talking about is like security guards that were interviewed, you know, stories that will blow your mind, like about construction happening before the heist. And a fellow who locked himself alone, a construction worker who locked himself alone in the security or in the office manager's office.
I forget the video, like the video monitoring office, the
CCTV.
It was like the foreman of the it was like the foreman. But yeah, exactly. What happened was this other conglomerate wanted to do a project on the heist. And when you start a project on the heist, whether it's a podcast or a documentary or a blog or something, you always cover like the usual suspects. Mm-hmm. And that takes up a season. Hmm. And that was probably what we were going to do if this other project hadn't limited us. But it forced us to get more interesting interviews and less of the interviews from people who have been interviewed 100 times about it and basically have a script and you don't get anything really new from it. And that podcast is great. Don't get me wrong. It's very well produced and they're going on season two.
I think so.
Season two, I think. But anyway, it's very well produced. They have a very good, like spearheading investigative journalists that are passionate about it. But what would you rather listen to? Like what's Steely Dan or like a Steely Dan like studio produced album, or like, I don't know, bringing Simon and Garfunkel live? Honestly, like what would you rather hear? Like something glossy produced, you know what you're getting, or something that's like raw and emotional and kind of off taking the punches and moving with it.
I agree. I'm gonna go for the raw and the gritty and emotional. That's kind of what we try to do with Vanish, is like, it's just, we try to keep it as like, you know, raw as possible when we do the show. And so like, I like that personally, but I mean, everybody's got a personal preference on production and how they want to hear, how they want to consume something.
We're kind of like the Fox News of Gardner heist.
Fox News of Gardner heist.
We're sort of like the Breitbart of Gardner.
I like it.
Just kidding.
I like it. I'll take it.
Well, for people who are listening that have no idea what the hell we're talking about, other than just like a gloss. I mean, I'll have Lance talk about this. Tell me a little bit about this place. This takes place in 90, right? 1990.
Yeah. St. Patrick's evening, March 18th or 19th. I always mess that up.
I thought it was maybe the 18th. I forget, but yeah. We're close.
Yeah. March 18th. We have the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, which is located in the Fenway neighborhood of Boston, Massachusetts. Back then, super niche museum, still a niche museum. Isabella Stewart Gardner was this like force to be reckoned with back in the 30s in Boston, and very wealthy, very, like I said, a force to be reckoned with. So she built this Victorian style. She had a Victorian style house. She built out the house to be a museum that housed her favorite artwork, which she would have prominent men bid, you know, and win for her at different auctions. And she would sort of be the puppet master behind the whole like bidding process. Super fascinating woman. If you get a chance to read anything about her, please do. Look up Liz Lenz. She's the one that wrote a bunch of stuff on her. And we have an interview with her as well. Very, very cool woman. So you have this museum that's been there forever. It's not the Museum of Fine Arts. It's this, again, Victorian style house, artwork that you're not going to see anywhere else. That night, March 18th, 1990, two security guards are working, and they are approached by two individuals that are dressed as allegedly Boston police officers. They ring the bell. They're let in. They proceed to guide the guards down to the basement, tie them up, bind them, duct tape. You'll see the famous picture of one of the security guards who's got his, like the duct tape is all around his head, his long hair is hanging out. And then they proceed to rob the museum for like 80 minutes, and they take 13 works of art, including what is probably the most valuable piece of art ever heisted from a museum, Vermeer's The Concert. That's I don't even know what that's valued at now. 50 million. Right now, I think the total the total value of all the art is over 500 million now.
It's amazing.
There's a $10 million reward on it if it's all returned in good condition. The fascinating part about it is the first thing you think about in that time period is like, must have been Whitey Bulger. Must have been the mob in Boston, Whitey Bulger. But no, it's not Whitey Bulger. It's not the mob. Like, it's not this person. It's not that person. This person gets killed. That person gets killed. Newspaper reporters claim to have gone to a warehouse, and they pull out the artwork, and it's unfurled in front of them, and newspaper headlines reveal, like, we found it, and it's not the art. Nothing's ever been found of it. Every rumor has always been like a dead end. Not a single piece of it has been found. No one's said anything. Lots of people have said that they know who did it, and they're wrong, or they're just lying, or whatever. But
including the FBI, didn't they seem to indicate that like the two people that did it were deceased? Like, how would they know that if they didn't if they didn't know who they were? Right. So that's
kind of, they have said that,
sure,
but they never showed their hand. Interesting. Although some recent news would suggest that could have been true, that they did know who it is. You know, I know that there was a few recent stories, one about a murder that happened in Lynn, Massachusetts, which isn't that far from Boston, that one of the Gardner heist, I guess you'd call them suspects, was rumored to have actually committed that murder, which was kind of a shock for, and this is just came out in the last month, because this suspect actually passed away not that long ago as well. So, so I think that kind of gave the museum and maybe the FBI a little bit more leeway to discuss that. So I don't know. I don't know if that's really the answers or not. You know, no artwork has been returned either way. So
yeah, wow. Here's what you get on Empty Frames. You get stories about security guards who will tell you what it's like to walk through the museum when it's dark, when no one's in there, after midnight, working the overnight shift. Tim mentioned the story about this guard that was working the front desk during some construction, and the foreman came in, pushed his way past the turnstile, and went into the
CCTV office.
And locked himself in, to the point where she had to call her manager. You also get stories like, we had a guest on, his name is Charles Pinning, and he had this theory about a young filmmaker, this like fringe filmmaker who made these very avant-garde movies in Boston and had some I don't know, circumstantial connection
he robbed a bank later. True. And his defense was that it was art, that
performance art,
the crime. Yeah. Yeah. Because he filmed it.
Well, damn, you don't want me on that jury then, because I'd throw it out if it was me.
But then if you go and you look at this individual's films that he's made, say, yeah, okay, this guy, it's not like he did it once. Like he's got a bucket of films that are just like full of like very bizarre, very like experimental type filmmaking.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it is within the realm of believability that he would talk with these young security guards and say, I'm going to shoot a movie in here. Yeah. And then we're going to take these paintings, and then it just gets out of hand. So you get that theory. I mean, yeah, it's probably not the case, but it's still like a great mental exercise.
It sure is. It's kind of like if Kubrick was an art thief and buried a lot of his clues in his early films or art, maybe you'd see some connection there. But yeah, it's a really reach for the connections, but there are some legitimate kind of creepy ones in a very like room, what is it, room 30, what is that, Shining
room 237, yeah. Room 237
in a very room 237 kind of way. Yeah.
And then we have Charlie Hill.
Yes, Charlie Hill is a legit, what was, rest in peace, he was a former Scotland Yard art investigator. He was an incredible story about, and just an incredible guy. I mean, it resonated right through the Zoom screen.
Yeah.
And he worked on the case, you know, was a legit professional investigator, art crime investigator, and was speaking with people that he believed knew where the art was. And he left some breadcrumbs in the interview with us. I don't think he knew he was going to pass away or anything like that, but he did leave a tiny, you know, a few breadcrumbs that you could probably follow in that interview. But I think that was his last interview ever about the case.
Wow. It was. He was 100% convinced. Mm-hmm. If he was wrong, then he had convinced himself otherwise, but he was convinced that he knew who did it, and he'd spoken to the people that were connected to it.
Right. So, and he did say that these two Irish brothers, they are deceased now, or at least actually one of them is missing.
One of them. Yeah.
And the other one, I think, believe was missing. So, and he said that they worked with the IRA at times, and they were from Ireland, but they were in Boston on vacation. And this wasn't like an IRA sanctioned job or anything like that.
Wow.
But they kind of just got in over their heads. Having some fun on St. Patrick's Day in Boston, apparently.
Jesus.
Those characters are true. Like there's parts of that that's definitely true, whether they robbed the museum or not. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, and you know, you're talking about some of the guests you guys have had on the show. You guys recently chatted with someone I know pretty well, Eric Euless, who from another case. I know you guys, so which on when we were on your show, so who didn't like DB Cooper? Who doesn't like DB? Which one of you didn't like him? Come on, fess up.
Lance calls him DB Cooper.
Oh, you son of a bitch.
I have.
Okay. I totally get it. But we had, you guys had him on the show. We had Eric on our show for our Cooper series. This one carries some eerie similarities to that one. Like people say it's a victimless crime, but it's really not. I mean, when you look at it in great detail, but this is a whole nother level as far as what it's worth today. But you know, a theft of pretty large proportions. I mean, Cooper was Thanksgiving Eve of 71, so I mean, you know, it's early, a lot earlier than this. But interesting sketches. You know, we have no conclusion here. Are you guys surprised with the sizable reward? You guys mentioned $10 million. That's a massive amount of money. Are you guys surprised that with that sizable reward that's out there in the ether now that we haven't made more headway here?
No. I'm not surprised.
Reward's kind of a trap it functions. And I think the security director of the museum will tell you that it's not, that you get a lawyer and you contact them. And maybe that's all true. I don't really know, but the way it's set up right now, is that all the art pieces need to be returned together in good condition. Yeah. It's like, well, okay, what are the chances that all 13 pieces are together and in good condition?
Yeah.
Like probably zero. Like, so,
yeah.
Right. Yeah.
You know,
after 32 years, I mean, that would mean that somebody who stole them would have to have them in like some hermetically sealed room or container, like
Tom Brady's bedroom.
Tom Brady's bedroom before he was born. Not before he was born, but $10 million. If
I mean, that's a lot of money for someone to turn over and rat on somebody. Like if they knew something, or if they knew something that could lead to the recovery, you know, if these things are intact, which I agree, it's probably likely, very unlikely, I should say. But I mean, you know, that's a lot of money. It's not just like a $500,000 reward. That's big money.
But if you had all the art,
right.
If you had all the art, you'd sell it for way more than that.
Or could you sell it? Sell it for way more than that? Like it
really doesn't, like I've gone through a lot of like ups and downs thinking this through.
Yeah.
Because obviously when they stole it, they didn't realize that it was going to escalate. Like,
yeah.
So they didn't realize, they knew it had value, but they didn't realize it was going to be like
stupid value,
you know, every year going up another like $50 million. And then people are dying. You know, like the people associated are dying. They're being found in the trunks of their car. If I have those paintings and I'm safe and I know no one knows, I'm not turning them in. I have a family.
Yeah.
I have my life. Like, oh, okay. You can do an anonymous tip and go through lawyers. I'm sorry. Like I may be under the influence of movies, but at some point that's coming back around to me.
Yeah.
Someone's getting to me. Look at Whitey Bulger.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I think that did I think if anyone was on the brink, if they knew where the paintings were and they were like, I think I can get away with this. Whitey Bulger was absolutely eviscerated in prison. Mm-hmm. Like they didn't even release like the amount of damage that was done to his body after he was murdered in prison. And that was after a couple of decades of like no action from him.
Yeah.
And people ripped him literally to pieces.
Yeah. Good Lord.
I there is no way
I'm
turning paintings in for $10 million.
Yeah.
There's no way I'm taking that risk.
Good point.
There was another story recently. I think this one came out in November about a jeweler who used to work in Boston, who was a friend of one of the former Gardner Heist suspects, named Bobby Donati, who did end up dead in the trunk of his own car, shot very many times, like no more than like a year after this. Paul Calantropo said that Bobby Donati visited him at his shop with the stolen finial from the Gardner heist, and sort of asked him what he thought he should do with it. And Paul told him he thought it was valueless because it was so hot at that point.
Yeah, but that's interesting. Yeah. You
know, yeah. So I don't know if that one's true or not either. I kind of think it easily could be, but I also think there is a market though, you know, for these things. Like I know, you know, it's sort of debated even on our show over the course of many episodes, if there's like a real life Dr. No, someone who's, you know, swirling wine in their mouth, walking in a villa. All their stolen
brandy
art.
Their heated snifter.
Yeah. And only showing their rich friends who will never tell anyone else, you know, like, the truth is there are people like that. I mean, do hear stories like that every year. People are found with stolen art like that. Even some famous people like Steven Spielberg found with very famous.
Oh, yeah.
Stolen, I believe, a Norman Rockwell. Just
Rockwell, yeah.
And the FBI.
And he's like, whoops.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, hey, I didn't know. Okay.
Right. Maybe. Yeah. Maybe not. Maybe
he didn't, Chris. Yeah.
Like, think about the time frame there. If you're employed by somebody to steal, like, paintings from the Gardner Museum, however that comes to be, whatever, you go in there. I don't believe that the perpetrators understood the real value.
Sure.
So then you take them, you go and stash them, and then you hear the news, you read the newspaper, you watch the news, and then it starts to sink in, and you start to think, wow, that's very valuable. Okay, we need to start thinking about how to offload this, and then before you know it, it's so valuable, like Tim said. That guy was like, yeah, I can't take this. This is so hot, it's worthless.
Yeah.
At what point does it become so hot, it's worthless?
That's a good point.
And then at what point after that does it become so not hot that you can,
like that you, insanely
now you
valuable.
Can place value to it?
That's a great question.
I mean, and then like, okay, so maybe some Dr. No character would have it, but who's sticking their neck out? The two individuals that did this, who's sticking their neck out to be like, hey, do you know a Dr. No type guy? You're just calling it out. Like you're calling yourself
right.
out. No, I'm asking for a friend.
Yeah.
Do you know somebody in Greece who drinks brandy out of a snifter looking at really expensive paint? I'm just asking. I'm just curious.
Yeah. It's a very specific.
You can't even Google that in 1990.
Right. That's very. I mean, that whole case is. I mean, I understand. I understand why you guys have done the show and everything. You know, tonight we've talked about We talked about Maura Murray. We talked about a little bit about Empty Frames. I know they're different. They're different cases altogether. Different, you know, carry different weight, of course. Do you guys think either of these cases ever get solved?
Yeah, I think we have to keep hope in to some degree, you know, or else it could just could be maddening. Just even kind of going through the ups and downs. I think some cautious optimism is good. Like not like jumping, as we kind of talked about earlier, like not jumping on every lead and getting our hopes up or anything. Yes, I think cold cases, you know, they do. Like, you know, we're living in a world where DNA is so prevalent these days. You know, there are cold cases that are solved almost every day. So yeah, I do have hope for both of them.
I agree. I think Maura Murray gets solved. I pray that case gets solved. I think about it often, you know, every year around the anniversary, I think about it. And you guys always post something on the anniversary and it's always very touching, and that's a sad case. And I think for the Gardner Museum heist, it's a different kind of a case, as obviously as we've mentioned, but it's like, you know, that's a case I think that should get solved, and hopefully one day maybe you know, history will get lucky and we'll be able to recover, you know, some of or not all of those priceless, really, like we've talked a lot about that tonight, but priceless artifacts really is what they are, is what it comes down to. And so
wouldn't that be something?
Boy, that really would be something.
Two like similar scenarios that I would have almost exact opposite reactions to. If there were any remains of Maura that are found in the future, that leads to the next mystery, which is how'd she get there? Yeah. Who did this to her and why? Yeah. And that's infuriating, but then you have to keep plugging away at that. Yeah, you need to figure out the next part of that investigation. If the Gardner artwork was suddenly discovered during some sort of construction or excavation or something, and it was in this box in the ground or something, or they drained, you know, the muddy river and there it is in this like trash bag, and it's somehow kept for all these years, and they pull it up and there's all 13 pieces, I don't care where it came from. Like, I don't care. It's kind of a fun mystery at that point to wrap your head around. Put it back in the museum and I'm fine with it.
Yeah,
you know, it's two different reactions to discoveries. Yeah. Like, if the artwork's found, it would be such a goddamn delight to walk into the museum and look at it. Yeah. Look at the storm on the Sea of Galilee right there. Like, it'd be amazing.
Yeah.
And we would take a camera in there and we would shoot ourselves walking through the museum, no matter what Anthony Amore says.
Yeah. You know, and that's, I feel like it's the same thing with, you know, with the Earhart thing. It's the same deal. Like, if the discovery of the Endurance that just made worldwide news, like if that proves anything, it's that we absolutely have the technology to find something like Earhart's plane that's only about 39 and a half feet long and 18,000 feet of water potentially, if that's where she's at.
Yeah.
You know, it's absolutely doable, and it's remarkable. I was just sitting there watching like the 4K video of like of the Endurance wreckage, and it's just like it's stunningly beautiful and eerie and just like amazing to see. And it's just I feel like, you know, if that plane is underwater somewhere and they pull that plane out of the water one day, or they have footage of that plane, it's, you know, I would be absolutely happy to stop the podcast and to just be like, hey, it's done, you know. And that's what we always wanted. I don't want this to go on. I want this to be solved. You know, I don't want to be doing this forever.
What if they pulled the plane out and DB Cooper was inside?
Oh, Jesus. That would be, you know, that would be pretty awesome, but physically impossible, but pretty awesome. I think that would be amazing.
Say almost physically impossible.
Yeah.
We can't say for sure.
You don't know. True. You don't know. Yeah, that's true. We'll find out. You know, it's the holy grail. For aviation, absolutely. For historical mystery, no question. It's the holy grail. So if they find that plane, when they find that plane, wherever it is, it's going to be pretty remarkable. And I think it's going to take, you know, like as wonderful as the Endurance was to be found, it's going to be like, you know, 1,000 times that all over the world if that thing is found. I'm looking forward to that day. I hope that happens. Before we get out of here tonight, you guys don't know this. Nobody ever knows this unless they listen to the show. We end every show on a really fun, sort of like lighthearted, I guess, but sometimes heavy, like questionnaire that we do on season one.
Lighthearted, but sometimes heavy.
Sometimes heavy, depending on the question. On season one, we did a tribute to Inside the Actor Studio and James Lipton, and kind of like the questionnaire he asked everybody that ever sat down with him. Season two, we're doing the Colbert questionnaire as a tribute to that. And I don't know if you guys have seen the show or heard of it or anything, but it's going to be fun. And I think we can, I'll get answers from both of you on these, and we'll wrap up tonight with some rapid fire questions and we'll get out of your way after that.
Sound good?
Sounds great.
All right. I will ask, I guess we'll have Tim go first. Tim, what is the best sandwich?
The best sandwich. Oof.
Yeah. I want this one.
I mean,
These are the hardest questions of the night, I promise.
You know, I might go with like a turkey club. I mean, yeah. That's a good one. I mean, I would normally maybe say chicken parm is my favorite, but I can't say that's the best, right? Like, because that's not for everybody.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Lance?
I'm on the Reuben.
On the Reuben. Yeah.
Reuben sandwich.
Reuben. Yeah, that's a good one.
Close second would be the Cubano, but Reuben.
Two good picks. Two good picks. Yeah. Tim, what is the one thing that you own that you really should throw out?
Old microphones. I don't know. Several microphones. A ton of old equipment, probably.
Yeah. What about you, Lance? What's the one thing that you would throw out that you really should throw out?
Mail. God damn it. Mail. Yeah. Can I just figure out when to throw out mail?
That's probably the best answer we've had. That's true. It's so obvious too, right? But everybody like overthinks it. And it's like mail, of course.
I'm looking at a stack of it right next to me. All of it's digitized. I don't need this. Right. Capital One sends me three things a day.
Mail and emails and calls and just between all that, it's there's so much unnecessary shit we don't need. Yes. Tim, what is the scariest animal?
The scariest animal.
Man.
I'll go with the great white shark.
That's a good one.
I don't want to get eaten. That's ever a good one. By anything.
Yeah. All right, Lance, what about you? Scariest animal.
Scariest animal. I think probably not like in the sense of danger, but God, have you ever heard a Fisher cat?
No.
Scream.
No. Uh-uh.
There's some terror in that.
I'll have to Google that now after this conversation.
Yeah. It sounds like a child screaming. And they're kind of nasty. Like they're just nasty. And I don't know how many like Fisher cat deaths there are, but you can get pretty well
demolished, like, maimed,
beaten down by them. Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
I'm going to Google that after. I'd say that. I'm going to Google that after this. All right. Apples or oranges? We'll start with you, Tim.
I go with an orange.
Oh, first orange this season. Everybody said apples so far. You're a maverick going with orange. All right, Lance, what about you? Apples or oranges?
No, I think I'm on the orange train. Yeah, you get a lot of good like stuff in there. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking just like to eat just as is, right?
Yeah, just apples or oranges. Yeah. If you're going to reach for something, what are you going to grab?
Oh, an orange.
All right, two oranges right off the bat. Okay, have you ever asked someone for their autograph?
Yeah, I was talking about this recently. Dominique Mociano, the old gymnast, actually signed my learner's permit when I was probably 16 and a half.
That's a very interesting signature on a very interesting document.
Yeah, that was really, really random. I know. But yeah, she happened to be at the Burlington Mall. Not signing autographs, just like there with her coach.
Nice. Nice. Lance, what about you? Did you ever ask for anybody for your autograph? Who was it?
The only person I asked for the autograph was William H. Macy on the set of State and Main.
Nice.
That was the only person I asked.
Yep. Nice. I have a Tonight Show when Jay Leno was hosting it. A Tonight Show ticket signed on one side by Leno and the other side by George Carlin.
Ah!
I got a chance. We were like George Carlin. My cousin and I are George Carlin like freaks. So we love all of us. We grew up on it. You know, sadly, we grew up on a lot of that stuff that he did, and we got a chance to meet him and get it. He like just initialed it, but it's like it's framed and everything. Like I'll never take it out of the glass. It's pretty amazing.
Isn't it great how he keeps like resurging?
Yeah,
the things timeless. That he said in the past just keep like coming back and being so applicable to today.
Yeah, he's timeless. His stuff is absolutely timeless, and it's like you can see stuff like 20, 30, 40 years ago that's just like holy shit, it's happening right now. And it's just like it's amazing that it's happening just like he said it would happen. It's pretty amazing. They're, you know, comedians are really remarkable thinkers.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That is true. But set your watches because he will be canceled at some point.
Yeah. Sadly. Yeah. That's sad. That's very sad. Okay. This is what I was talking about. Like some of these questions are a little bit deep. We'll start with, we'll go to Lance on this one. What do you think happens when we die?
I think a lot of people will be sad for a while. I stole that from Keanu Reeves.
I know you did, but that's so good though. I wasn't gonna say it if you didn't say it, but it's probably the best answer ever given to that question though. It's very true. It really is. Tim, what do you think? What happens when we die?
We get buried or cremated?
Yeah.
No, I'm just going with the same cop-out answer as Lance and Keanu. No, I mean, I don't know. I think there's some kind of energy going on I think there's some kind of soul or whatever you'd want to call it. I don't know what the heck that means. I don't know where that goes, anything like that, but I tend to keep that belief that that there's something going on afterwards.
Yeah, that's I agree with you. All right, Lance, what's your favorite action movie ever of all time?
I mean, it's really hard to see. For a while it was probably The Road Warrior, Fury Road came out, and it's really tough for me to not say Fury Road.
That's a good one. Yeah, Fury Road is pretty remarkable. Yeah, there's some great
ones. It really
is. There's some great ones.
Yeah.
Tim, you got one to add?
Shoot to Kill with Sidney Poitier and
Tom Berenger.
God, Tom Berenger, man. Jeez. Yeah. He's great. Tom Berenger's great. I love when I see him pop up in random movies like Training Day and stuff. And like, I was just like, man, it's so cool to see him like pop out in movies like that. I love Tom Berenger. I'm a Tom Berenger fanboy. Okay. Favorite smell. And we'll start with, we'll stick it with Tim. Favorite smell.
Thank you for asking. Paper, fresh cut paper, like the middle of like a book.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I love it.
That's a good one. Yeah,
I love it.
Yeah,
or new electronics. The
wafting of it.
Yeah, even new electronics. Give me that.
So that's so good. Mm-hmm. That's so true. Yeah, Lance. What about you? Favorite smell?
It's a tie, probably between bergamot and like a good like smoked something on a grill.
Yeah. Just that overall, that smell of like that, something cooking on the grill or smoking on the grill. That's really good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not so much like you want it, like it makes you hungry. It's just like, you know what that represents.
Mm-hmm. I have a similar notion with that, with like fresh cut cedar.
Yeah.
Like just that smell of like, just that smell, it just smells so, I can't explain it. It's just a wonderful smell. I love that smell.
Well, I mean, it just goes into your
subconscious almost.
Olfactory.
Yeah. Yeah.
Senses.
Olfactory nerve and senses.
And then that like triggers memories and
Yeah. It's amazing how that happens. What about the opposite, Tim? What's your least favorite smell?
Boiled spinach.
I hate spinach. My wife eats that stuff, man. She just like makes a spinach dip and it's like the most disgusting shit ever. And it just like my wife and son love it. I can't understand how they can eat it. I got to be out of the room when they're eating it. That's how bad. That's how sensitive my nose is to that smell. And so like, I was like, nah, you're making that, I'm out. Like, I got to go, I'm going to the room or I'm going to be downstairs or something. I can't do it. I hate it that much.
I discovered that I actually like raw spinach, but really don't like the cooked or boiled spinach. That's really,
There's no real need to eat it either. Like, you're not getting any real nutrients out of boiled spinach. It's all like boiled away. So stick to the raw.
Yeah. I don't know why people do that. That's true. That's true. That's a very good point. Yeah. All right, Tim, is exercise worth it?
Oh yeah, totally.
It is worth it. Lance, what do you think? Exercise, is it worth it?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Exercise fuels your brain.
Mm. Flat or sparkling, Tim?
Oh, definitely flat.
Thank you for saying that.
You're talking about the earth, right?
No, I'm talking about flat. I'm talking about water.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Flat Same or sparkling answer. Water. That's great. All right, Lance, what about it? Flat or sparkling?
Yeah, flat. I mean, and don't get me wrong, I'll do a sparkling in the right place and time, but the go-to is flat.
All right, well, here's an interesting one. This will tell us a lot about you guys. What is the most used app on your phone? And we'll start with you, Tim.
I mean, I guess it's the text message app.
Yeah,
right?
I guess
is that a cop-out answer?
No, that's good. That's good.
It's got to be one of those.
That's good. That works. I'll buy that. Lance, how about you?
Yeah, I'd say that's probably the same for me, but second to that would be like the weather app.
The Reface app.
You guys are living life on the edge. Lance, you only get one song to listen to for the rest of your life. What is that song?
Oh, I want to give a joke answer. I really
give it to
do.
Me. What's the answer?
But
God, give me the joke and the real one.
I don't know. The one song I would listen to for the rest of my life. God, there's so many good ones.
I know. That's a hard question. Really is.
I would listen to the third. This is going to sound so geeky. The third movement to Moonlight Sonata by Beethoven.
Well, that's a hell of an answer, though.
I literally could listen to that on repeat.
That's a great answer. That's a definitely a great answer. Tim, what about you? What's the song you're picking for the rest of your life if you have to listen to one song?
I think it's Ooh La La by The Faces.
Interesting. Interesting picks. Okay.
Good.
Yeah. Interesting picks. Good. All right. A couple more and then we'll wrap up tonight. Tim, if heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
You have a face for television.
That's great. I like it. Lance, what about you?
You're in charge. I don't know. I would like God to say to me, have you been introduced to my friend DB Cooper?
Oh, Jesus. Yeah. All right. I'll go with
it. Then I'd be like, you son of a
bitch. Go with you. That's who you're spending eternity with.
Then I'm like, I am in hell.
He's going to tell you. Yeah. He's going to tell you what he did every day for the rest of eternity.
Yep. That's how you're going to spend eternity. That's what you deserve. Okay. On that note, the last question I'm going to ask you guys is every time I do this with co-hosts, people that like work on a show together, I always ask this question. Tim, I'll start with you. Tell me the favorite thing about working with your co-host.
How he asks me how I'm doing after we start rolling and introduce the show after we've already been on Zoom for an hour or two, usually that day. But the way he asks it, it's so earnest and you can tell it comes through. He means it every time.
Oh, man.
Yeah, well, that's amazing.
That's honesty. Honesty at its greatest. Lance, how about you? What's the best thing about working with Tim?
I mean, hands down, it's like, and this is no insult to anything, but sometimes you need to have a couple of like lighter moments. Mm-hmm. And if you're in the middle of a very heavy interview, it's okay to have a little text message on the side during the interview that might be something that'll make you laugh.
Yeah.
And I think like keeping going during, I think that adds to a better, more energized interview.
Yeah.
Is somebody to keep you on your toes, whether it's like, you know, you see the text message pop up in the on the side of the screen and you're like, that's totally not associated with what we're talking about, and I'm trying to really keep it together right now. It just helps.
Yeah.
Like it's in no way to be disrespectful, it's just to keep things sharp,
right?
And that's what I appreciate.
Yeah. Two excellent points made here tonight as we wrap up. Tell us where we can find the show. I mean, I know it's everywhere, but tell us, give us the website, give us where we can find Empty Frames, give us where we can find, tell us where we can find Missing. Plug all that jazz, please.
Cool. Well, go to check out crawlspace-media.com. That's where you'll find everything, all things Crawlspace media related. Missing is one of the podcasts. Empty Frames is another one. We also do one called Crawlspace. You can find those wherever you get your podcasts.
Awesome. Thank you guys, both of you. You know, like I said, I'm a fan. I appreciate you both. Thank you for doing the show. And I look forward to working with you guys in the future. Who knows what might pop up for us to get together and collaborate on. So, until then.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you very much. This is a blast.
Super fun.
Another conversation behind us. Thanks for hanging out with me and my friends. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media as we post each new conversation as they air. News, show information, and more. Go to facebook.com/meandmyfriendspod. On Twitter, you can search the handle meandmyfriendspod. And on Instagram, search the handle meandmyfriendspod. If you enjoyed the conversation tonight, please do me a favor and head to Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcatcher and rate us and leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. Me and My Friends is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by me, Chris Williamson. The show's music is created and performed by producer Riddiman. The opinions on Me and My Friends are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Eben Films Incorporated. Chris Eben Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. Any audio clips used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of education and entertainment, and no infringement is ever intended. Me and My Friends is an exclusive trademark of Chris Eben Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Eben Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Me and My Friends is a Chris Eben Films production, copyright 2022, all rights reserved.